orange juice over the whole bird, sprinkle on some paprika, and put it in the oven. That's how I ate chicken every Friday night growing up. You can open your eyes now. I was brought up in a kosher home. Observing the laws of kosher, one must follow several rules specifically around foods that are allowed and forbidden to eat, the separation of milk and meat products, and using different dishes to serve dairy foods versus meat foods. These practices separated me from most, if not all, of my friends when it came to eating out and eating at their homes. Growing up, I never tasted a BLT or ate at McDonald's or drank a glass of milk with a hamburger. So even though my friends didn't make fun of me because of my family's practices, I felt different from my peers. Even before I turned 16, I can remember thinking I didn't want to eat meat anymore. I would pass on the Friday night chicken, for sure, not eat the burgers at barbecues, and skip the pastrami at the kosher deli. When I was 14, my sister stopped eating meat, and my mom would always complain how hard it was to cook for her. I was definitely envious of my sister's ability to make that decision for herself, but I waited till she moved out for my turn. Shortly after turning 16, I announced that I no longer would eat meat, poultry, or fish because I didn't want to eat another living thing. Over the next 4 years, 2 years of high school and 2 years in college, I didn't eat very well, mostly carbs and some vegetables, but I hadn't really learned how to cook vegetarian foods yet. Despite this, I stuck to it based on my moral view of my decision, as well as the mocking I get from my family and relatives. Who knows, maybe the mocking only reinforced my decision to be different and to do something different than my relatives and how I grew up. From 1978 to 84, I lived abroad and I was surrounded by fresh vegetables and fruit. This definitely catapulted me into my vegetarianism and eating healthy. I learned how to increase my protein intake with the foods I combined. I was taught how to make salads galore, and I shopped for all of my own food, thus making my own decisions about what I ate. When I returned to the States and met Kurt, we were both vegetarians, which made for easy cooking and common ground in our relationship. Over the years, I've learned about the negative environmental and global impacts that eating meat can bring, and I've stayed steadfast in my convictions to stay to a vegetarian diet.
I didn't write anything down. I'm just going to tell you why I eat meat from time to time. I wouldn't call myself a carnivore. I don't eat meat that much. When I was growing up, meat was special just for economic reasons. And so as a kid, we ate what we got and we appreciated the food that we had. And food was about how it made you feel. And I remember as a kid eating chicken hearts because we ate, you know, the giblets of the chicken, not just the chicken meat. And do that nowadays. They don't eat those parts, it seems. And my brother and I love the little chicken hearts. And it was more, they were good for us and they made us feel good and we appreciated it. And I feel that it was a sacred thing that we were doing to eat the food and give thanks for it. But still we didn't eat a lot of meat. And when I went to college, I feel like I lost the ability to digest meat. And I didn't enjoy it anymore, and I stopped eating it for a long time. And that's also the time that I learned about factory farming, which I don't see how you can enjoy eating something that was tortured its whole life. And so when I was living in California, I never ate meat. And my husband, who also lived in California, he was born there, his family was, I got to put in a, tell my husband's story too, because he was supposed to be part of this talk, but he would not. He doesn't like being in front of people. His family ate meat, and his father was very adamant. We must have steak and potatoes every day. And my poor husband, as a boy, hated meat. He couldn't stand it. And as soon as he could choose to not eat it, he wouldn't. And so he's been a vegetarian ever since, you know, he was a teenager and could finally put his foot down. But again, his reasoning was that it didn't go with him. Eating meat was not a happy thing for him. He didn't come to it from a moral thing, exactly. When I moved to Vermont, I was still a vegetarian. And then I met a lot of hunters. And a coworker of mine had all this moose in his freezer that he needed to get rid of to make room for the next animal. And he offered me a bunch of moose. And I said, no, I'm a vegetarian. And then I went home and I started thinking, well, the moose had a happy, good life, and there's no reason I shouldn't eat it. So I said, sure, I'll have some of that. And it was really good. And then he gave me some venison, and that was really good. And then when I moved to Rutland, I found a source of grass-fed, happy beef. And it's this woman at Farmer's Market, and she's got pictures of the animals, and they have names, and I know that some people have the opposite view, that they would never eat an animal that had a name, but I feel that I would only eat an animal that had a name. Because, or a wild animal, because it shows that that animal was loved. And okay, its life was a little shorter, but it had a life, and it had a good life. So, Zeno is in my freezer right now, for parts of him, and he's really good. And when I eat that meat, I feel good. I feel, and again, I eat meat, what, anywhere from once to 10 times a year, I don't know, 20 times a year, maybe, and it just, it adds life to my life. And so, to me, that's the sacred thing, is that Zeno or this moose or that deer had a life full of life, and now their life is part of my life, as my life, when I die, will go to be part of other lives.
For the past 20 years or so, I have been an ovo-lacto vegetarian, eating eggs and dairy, but no meat or fish, or as Bill would say, nothing that has a face and a mother. Prior to becoming a vegetarian, I ate omnivorously, anything and everything, hearts, sweetbreads, you name it. I'm a person who finds moderation difficult. I quit smoking and drinking because I couldn't be moderate. Those are practices, habits you can quit, but you can't quit eating. During my last weekend as a carnivore, I saw someone I hadn't seen in a year and was struck by the incredible change he had made, losing 100 pounds that he needed to lose in a year. I asked him how he had done it, and he said that he had had a heart attack and become a vegetarian. Since I weighed more than I wanted to at the time, I thought I might give it a try. At least it would restrict me from one source of food intake and perhaps result in weight loss. My last dinner was sweetbreads, which most meat eaters don't seem to enjoy. The following day, I had breakfast sausage on an airplane flight when they still serve food on transcontinental flights. I wish I had stopped with the wonderful memory of sweetbreads, but the sausages were pretty convincing in their lack of appeal. At that time, I hadn't made a long-term commitment to eating vegetarian. I then read a book which influenced me significantly and helped me make a lasting decision. Written by two qualified nutritionists, The Vegetarian Way focuses on nutritional aspects of a vegetarian diet, as well as the reasons for and a path to becoming a vegetarian. If I needed convincing that being vegetarian was a more environmentally sustainable way to eat, the authors provided it. 1 acre of farmland will support 7 people if it is used to grow grains and beans for human consumption. It will support less than 1 person if that same acre is given over to producing milk and meat. Being vegetarian is the single most important thing I can do to lower my carbon footprint. In the time since I became vegetarian, it has become progressively easier, with most restaurants including nutritious and delicious vegetarian entrees. There are a number of meat substitutes and preparations of soy particularly that are extremely easy to work with and very tasty. Just ask Bill if he thinks he is giving something up by having a vegetarian meal. There are lots of reasons for being vegetarian: environmental, ethical, health, sanitary. Have you ever done the dishes and looked at the difference between the meat and the vegetable? Yeah. Sanitary, practical, even financial. All apply to me in some degree, except that I spent my summers in my childhood on a farm and do not have a visceral reaction to the killing of animals for their meat. I do hate driving by feedlots on the plains, and many practices in the meat-raising industry are cruel, even barbaric. I don't consider myself an ethical vegetarian, but I feel particularly good about the choice when I consider a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson: "You have just dined, and however scrupulously the slaughterhouse is concealed in the graceful distance of miles, there is complicity." I haven't met my goal of weight control simply by being vegetarian, but I do have a practice and discipline that is part of my daily life, sometimes more conscious than others, but always with me. I am more mindful about what I eat because of my choice to be vegetarian.
As you know, I'm a biologist, or my background a long time ago is a biochemist. I am a biologist by training, and I have this kind of, it's not a justification for the way I eat, but there's a little question in my mind that it is not a particular health hazard to be eating meat, and I'm not a carnivore strictly. I am, of course, an omnivore. I eat a variety of different things, and I have all my life, as far as I can remember. The reverence for an animal that is the source of one's nutrition and part of one's diet, to me, I think of it more like an ecology sort of relationship, that we descend from hunter-gatherers that pretty much went out when they were hungry, unlike the lion in the story, which was delightful. They ate pretty much anything they could come upon, and our closest relatives and other species are chimpanzees, and they're omnivores. It's not a particularly bothersome thing for me to think about that. I have concerns about my health, and my cholesterol is so low, my doctor sometimes they just get wide-eyed if they haven't do that, and it's genetic. And so if that were an issue, I suppose I would do something to regulate my diet. But as for the reverence of the animal as a source, it's something that I think it deserves some thinking. And I appreciate the rationale of people who would not, by their own hand, take the life of an animal in order to sustain themselves. And I can appreciate that. I recall a wonderful story that probably means as much to me in this area as anything. It has to do with Native Americans and one particular hunting technique. The hunting technique is quite literally to run down an herbivore. That is to say, jog, run, relentlessly pursue one hunter after one deer. Deer, you see, physiologically are built for the sprint. That is to say, when a cougar or a predator dives out of the woods to kill them and eat them, they can sprint a longer distance than the predator, and then they stop, and they escape the hazard. But the Native American Indian doesn't rest, just keeps going, and eventually comes upon, after several spurts of prey, upon a totally exhausted deer that just can't even move anymore. It's completely done. All it can do is just stand there on all fours. And the rather moving depiction of this, which apparently is a true story, passed mouth by mouth in oral tales from one generation to the next, is the hunter walks up and with a particular herb in the hand, covers the nostril and mouth of the deer that then dies of anoxia and falls to the ground. And then there's, as you've read, there's a kind of a prayer that takes place at that moment. It's a thankfulness that this deer came available, and there's some kind of honesty in the chase of the deer. It's just a kind of a worship of the harmony that is displayed in that. Now that's a long shot from the feedlots, I admit. And frankly, on ethical and moral grounds, I have nothing to stand on in my omnivorous diet. I know that. It's probably one of the sort of lesions in my mental ethic, if you know what I mean to say. But I'm going to keep doing it. I like the taste of meat, and I feel okay about the balance.
Appreciate everybody who has already spoken. Let me tell you, I remember as a child, I was only about 4 years old, and my mother was serving pork, and I said, "What's pork?" And she said, "Oh, that's pig." I said, "Oh, how do they get the pork from the pig?" And she said, "They kill it." And that visceral reaction that I had as a child, I think is probably the visceral reaction that almost everybody in this room has when we talk about the fact that we kill animals, we exploit animals. There's a level of discomfort with that that you probably feel automatically. It's the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And if you're unwilling to be exploited, if you're unwilling to be killed for your meat or for some other service, perhaps you don't do that to another creature. When I was not a vegetarian for a long time, and I can tell you, that whole episode just sort of evaporated, as it does for everybody. We all have this amazing ability to bifurcate our thinking. And things that are out of sight, that we don't see, we can easily dismiss, and we just go on and we do our thing. And I will tell you, I'm standing here talking about vegetarianism. Look, I know there's child abuse going on. I know there's spousal abuse going on. I know about the depredations that are taking place in Iraq, in Iran, and Afghanistan now. And you know, I'm not doing anything about that. And I don't know that I can do much, but I'm not going to demonstrations. I'm not writing to my congressman. There's a lot that I'm not doing. This happens to be one area of life in which I can do something. And by the way, what's kind of nice about this one is I don't have to do something. I have to not do something. So it's a little bit easier in that sense. I think I kind of stand here in front of you as if it is 1750, maybe 1800, something like that. And I'm an abolitionist. And I'm saying to you, you know, it's not right to have black slavery. It just isn't okay. They're human beings. They're sentient. And people are looking at me and they're saying, no, they're animals. They're animals. And if they're animals, we can treat them anyway. We want. We can beat them, we can enslave them, we can take their labor, we can exploit them, we can kill them. I don't think that that's as inapt as you're probably thinking right now, as I, from my head, have said that. Because I want to talk a little bit about the history, the arc of history here. You know, if you're Vikings, We would have done well. We would have gone out, we would have raided England, and we would have raided Ireland, and we maybe came to North America. And we just did that, right? We still engage in warfare as a regular event, don't we? But over time, the Vikings stopped raiding. Warfare, we have now introduced this concept of rules of engagement. Isn't that interesting? We have different paradigms for how we go about them. When we talk about slavery, we ended slavery at some point because we recognized something about those people. If we think about criminal punishment, at one time we beat people, we would humiliate them, we would do whatever. But we have changed that paradigm. When we treated the insane, we would lock them up in, it was called bedlam, and we would throw away the key, and we didn't care about them. When we talked about race relations, we knew blacks, oh no, they're not like us, right? We don't have to afford them privileges. We were going to have white bathrooms and black bathrooms, and we're not going to interface. How about women? What's happened in terms of the women's movement since 1970, whatever, with feminism and the treatment of women? Or child labor? Or how about, and this is very recent, the idea that gays can marry? What's consistent throughout that whole history is we start to recognize that we're not talking about the other anymore. We're talking about ourselves. We're talking about other creatures, other people who actually are just like us. When we look at the treatment of animals, you know, we've seen the elimination, or we try to see the elimination of blood sports. No more cockfighting, no more dogfighting, we hope. Bear baiting has gone by the board. The fox hunts in England have gone by the rules. How about the creation of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals? And the various legislation that's now enacted, at least at the federal level, the Animal Welfare Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the Humane Slaughter Act. So I want to challenge you to think a little bit about what has set the stage for this. First off, affluence. And I want to be real clear about this. Affluence makes a big difference. If we're out there and we're hunter-gatherers and we're out on the plains, you don't have a choice, do you? You eat, as Bill said, what you can find. And I really have no problem with that. However, in the affluent society, we have this great ability to step back and be a little introspective. We can sit down, we can talk about this. And interestingly enough, the ideas of empathy and compassion, these are affluent concepts. You know, we can't really do that if we're desperate for our own very existence. I think we're seeing empathy is on the increase all the time. And I think you are more empathetic probably now than you may have been 10 years ago. You may be more inclined to include other people as being people like yourself, and to be empathetic and to express some compassion for them. I thought one thing that came to my mind was in 1914, during the First World War, you know, at Christmas time, I'm sure you've all heard this story, there was a truce, and the Germans and the British, it was pretty much those two groups, came out of the trenches, and they faced each other, and they played soccer, and they shared their rations, and did whatever. And how much more difficult did it become at that point for them to go back and challenge and shoot that other guy, who now has a face, right? Who we feel is not the other. Last Sunday, Nicholas Kristof had a really good article in the New York Times, I don't know if you saw that, about chickens and the treatment of chickens. And he said, and this is interesting, most American consumers are like me, conflicted. We eat meat, but we don't want animals to suffer needlessly. One national poll last year found that 81% of consumers said that it was important to them that the chickens they eat be humanely raised. He goes on and he says, I raise chickens as a farm boy. They're not as smart as pigs or as loyal as dogs, but they make great moms, they can count, and have distinct personalities. They are not widgets. A couple of years ago, Terry Gross was interviewing a vegetarian on the program, and he was Jew and had been raised in the 1950s and had known lots of Holocaust survivors. And he said one of the important things that struck him that led to his vegetarianism was when the survivors of the Holocaust said they treated us like animals. And if we invert that statement and say we treated animals like them, what does that do in terms of your calculus, in terms of your willingness to treat animals this way? There's a totality and a continuum throughout the world. People, animals, plants, the earth itself. It's a unity. There's one thing. And to me, the choices we make in our lives involve how we're going to treat that continuum, that totality. I like to think that what I'm doing is that I'm seeking less violence, less brutality in every, hopefully in just about everything that I'm doing. And so I'm hoping that as a part of what I'm doing as a vegetarian is leading to a more peaceful world. Now look, I want to be very clear, I don't have a perfect solution. Somebody has said to me, oh, you're a dairy and ovo-lacto vegetarian. If you buy anything from the dairy farms, you're automatically implicated and you're part of the problem. Well, I understand that, but I want to take whatever small steps I can take, one step at a time. I can't solve the entire problem, I know that. And I'm not looking to, but I can take a step. So I want to just conclude by one thought that I kind of have, and that is I believe I'm probably standing in front of you very much as that abolitionist in 1800 saying, you know, think about what your children are going to say, or your grandchildren or great-grandchildren, and I don't know if this is 300 years or 500 years, but are they going to look back at you and say, you did what? So that's sort of where I am with the vegetarian. So, and I'm sorry I couldn't get the sound.
Okay. So, now the response time.